Hi, my name is Michael Kramer and welcome to a podcast focused on the booming logistics and warehouse market globally. Today I'm going to be talking to two leading industry experts about the global market and the boom in e-commerce and really what we think is going to be happening over the next 5 years of what must be undoubted growth. The industrial logistics market has become a favorite of the media and the press. There's lots to talk about. So let me introduce two people. Rob Hall, who's an international partner and head of logistics and industrial at Cushman & Wakefield, with a focus on the Europe, Middle East and African markets. And Jeremy Giles, global head of customer-led solutions at Prologis. And Jeremy is based in the US. So this really will be a global conversation. What I'd like to do, Jeremy, is maybe start with you and start with the North American market. And maybe you could give us a perspective of your customers and how they're thinking in today's markets.
Certainly. And thanks for having me today, Michael. The North American market, is generally pretty tight. If you think about where the market is this time, say in comparison to the global financial crisis, we entered the year in the U.S. with vacancy in the mid-4s, call it 4.5%, versus double-digit vacancy in 2010. And so our customers, as they expand, they're struggling, I think, to find space. I also would add, I think our customers are thinking globally, well outside of the U.S. or outside of North America. Just for context, more than 95% of our top 25 customers are global. So these are customers we're typically dealing with on four continents, and they're facing an increasingly complex world. They're navigating changing consumer tastes and demands, trade tariffs, Brexit, shifts in transportation cost and capacity, COVID, and that's just a few of the considerations. Many of these customers are working through significant shifts in their global supply chain. A shift from efficiency that they've had over the last several years to resiliency, from just in time to more just in case inventory. So maybe in the past, they've stress test their balance sheet and now they're stress testing their supply chain as well. And this was a trend that was in place before COVID. And it's been accelerated during COVID. But even before, we saw customers carrying more inventory to try to offset changes in tariffs. The second thing I think I'd note is how they're handling the peak. And the peaks in the old brick and mortar world were pronounced, but they've become much more pronounced in an e-com world where labor that you need at peak, warehouse capacity, transportation capacity. The old peak might be 2x and now it's several x. And we've seen the e-com providers through things like Singles Day and Amazon Prime Day spread that out, but it's still an issue. And this spring, we saw several years of e-com adoption accelerated into a couple of months. And our customers now say they're operating in a permanent unplanned peak, and they really wonder what this holiday season holds.
Let me just jump in there and ask you a question. You talk about the peak. So you're talking about days or weeks, are you, when there is a much heavier demand on the, let's call it, the logistics networks to deliver the goods that they have? And is that when you talked about this Black Friday, the Singles Day? Can you just kind of explain that in a bit more detail?
I think we'll probably touch on labor through our conversation today, but e-com is very labor intensive, and it's particularly an issue when you're moving a whole lot more parcels or items in a given period. That ends up being a capacity in a shed. It ends up being a capacity within labor. Transportation's a big deal, and that's even more pronounced in COVID. A lot of the air freight travels via belly freight in passenger planes. And with passenger flights off, air freight is very restricted. And a lot of it right now is utilized by PPE and other critical items. So as we've all worked from home and we're all receiving more and more e-commerce packages, that peak has become almost permanent now. But the holiday season is right around the corner, and we're going to see what that looks like as well.
Interesting. Maybe there's a whole bunch of things in there that I'd like to come back to, the whole sort of labor arbitrage and technology and whether that's displacing labor. And as you said, that's something for a bit later on. Before we do, let's flip to you, Rob. You know, we've obviously heard what's going on in North America, the fact that the customers are global, that there's a permanent peak, and that all seems very sort of logical. What are you seeing from the UK and across Europe that's the same and maybe some things that are different?
Hi, Michael, and hi, Jeremy. There are many, many similarities, actually, between the US and Europe. So where things are similar, they are very similar. It's interesting. You look at the US GDP against the EU GDP. There's a bit of a lead for the US, but it's by a mere $4 or $5 trillion dollars out of $21 trillion. So similar size economies, if you like. But you look at the geographies, the population, they're also pretty similar. In fact, you look at the densities of that population. Europe is about 73% urban. The US is about 80% urban. And that is really relevant when we come on to look at e-commerce and last mile distribution and so on, or in fact, how the whole of logistics works. So between the US and Europe, there are many things in common. And then, of course, there are a number of differences. And some of those are the obvious, the legal, the languages, and the complexity there. And some of it is actually approached by governments on how they support industry and labor laws and so on. All of that plays into the real estate world, where actually, interestingly, Jeremy mentioned the vacancy rates in the market in North America. They're very similar in Europe. Across the board, they're sort of 5 to 5.5% vacancy rates. There's rental growth still, unlike perhaps the office and the retail sectors where clearly there's been a lot of stress over the last 6 months. So that actually is very similar. We then look at e-commerce penetration, and there has been the similar exponential rise in e-commerce. I mean, the UK alone has gone from about 15% online sales pre-COVID to about 30% online sales, and CACI are saying that may level out at about 40% of retail spend will be online. So many similarities, a few differences. But if I just turn to the customers for a moment, similar global customers, logistics is global. It's an $8 trillion industry, logistics. 80% of the food people consume is produced or grown, manufactured across a different border to them. So the whole dynamic of global trade is very much there and is very much adjoined by ships floating the ocean, the trains and the roads that link it. And of course, ultimately, the real estate, which binds it all together and gets it to us as consumers.
Interesting. And I think you both touched on a couple of things which I wanted to pick up and come back to you, Jeremy. So in a pre-COVID world, we had low unemployment, I'm assuming as a result of that rising wage or increased wage inflation. We got a labor-intensive market. COVID has maybe accelerated all of those things, obviously as this increase in online sales has gone up, the pressure on costs is going up. Rob, you've mentioned rental rates, so property costs are going up. Jeremy, how's that sort of being dealt with by your customers? And maybe start with labor, but you know, there's obviously a link between labor and automation now. Can you maybe give us an insight into what your customers are thinking about doing to sort of offset some of those costs?
Yeah, Michael, we stay very close to our customers. And I remember asking one last year, what are your top three problems? And he looked at me like, you don't know. He said, well, number one is labor, number two is labor, and number three is labor. I'm very visual, so I'm not sure if this works in an audio podcast. But I think about the old model of bricks and mortar distribution, where we have somebody with a forklift, a few people moving around some pallets. And that's so dramatically different than picking eaches and putting them in a box and shipping them to our houses. Even with automation, e-commerce is very labor intensive. And look no further than an aerial of an Amazon or anyone else's e-com facility and the amount of parking that's involved. You can see how labor intensive it is. And all of that within a context of some pretty interesting demographic trends. So last year, for the first time in the history of the planet, we passed a line where there are more people over 65 on the earth in the people under five. And think about how pronounced that is in the largest economies of the world. So that's not a problem that's going away anytime soon. We were also seeing automation pick up even pre-COVID, and I think we'll see it accelerate from here. And again, the old model was very fixed. It was very expensive. It was a long implementation with a long payback. And we'd hear horror stories that you'd get to the end of the implementation, they'd change the business model or the SKUs, and it was almost out of date before it was delivered. The new automation trends are much more flexible. So think about automation as a service, cobots where you have goods to humans, robots working right alongside humans to make them more efficient. That's the trend that we see now from a lot of customers.
Interesting. There's a term I've heard before, cobots. So that's a person doing something but being augmented by a robot, is it?
Exactly. It could be something like the robot bringing the shelf to the person, so there's less walking around would be one example of that.
And Rob, if we flip it back to you, we've talked a little bit about what's happened in terms of COVID, but do you want to go into that in a bit more detail? What are some of the real changes that you think will be here to stay?
The whole COVID scenario, as Jeremy has said, has accelerated trends. I think during those early days of the pandemic, supply chain resilience was really in focus. And I think it's interesting that some analysts did count up 30,000 investor relation mentions of supply chain resilience in the first half of the year. So I think that put into the spotlight the importance of supply chain right at the outset. I think now we're 6 months into the pandemic and very unfortunately, many of us are going through a second wave now. There's perhaps a slightly different dynamic to it. And I think a lot of our views and concerns within the industry, both with Jeremy from the investor side and myself from the occupier side, are about the delivery of the vaccines. There was a report by the International Air Transport Association this week, which said that it's the equivalent of 8,000 jumbo jets of vaccine need to be distributed. You then look at how we're going to deal with the vials and the swabs and the whole sort of whole impact and, if you like, the sweep up of the vaccines is hugely important. And this is going to need to be a military operation for the whole supply chain industry and for governments if we are going to get vaccines out to billions of people worldwide. So I think that's a challenge we actually haven't yet seen, but I think it's an absolutely critical one, particularly, and Jeremy will see it across North America, and we see it here in Europe, there is a real shortage of chilled and cold storage in supply as well. So I think that's one of the big challenges we face. There is another, and it is linked to supply chain, and it's one our customers have been seeing, is just their office space, the working from home element. When people talk about working from home, they often think that really just relates to office occupiers. Believe me, it doesn't. It very much relates to the office functions within the supply chain industry and how that plays out, and indeed how that will play out in future warehouse design, which is probably a subject for a completely new pod, Michael. But I think there are definite thoughts, and I know this is something Jeremy and the Prologis team are looking at, and we're looking at with our customers, about what this means for the design of warehouses. And Michael, if I can just pick up on just going back to what Michael was talking about, automation, I think it's really important to also consider digitization and the likes of blockchain and the visibility and transparency of seeing your customer's customer's customer. I think that whole digital process is really critical. And an awful lot of customers are looking at how they expand blockchain into their supply chain. And the other thing, of course, is automation in terms of guided vehicles and electronic vehicles and so on, which, of course, is not within the warehouse environment, but is very much within the supply chain environment.
And is that, and maybe back to you, Jeremy, there's a couple of things I wanted to pick up on, but one was last mile delivery. And obviously that relates a lot to technology, but it is what Rob just talked about in terms of electric vehicles. Obviously they work well in city centers as well as on the open road, so to say. Is that something that you're seeing, and is that changing anything in the location of warehouses and distribution centers?
Yeah, Michael, it's a great point. Last mile distribution has a lot of complexity that your traditional greenfield development on outside the ring road might have. The sites are very hard to come by. The entitlements are very tough. Communities want the service, but they don't necessarily want the use in their community. So there's a big focus on what those buildings are like, what kind of emissions they create. And so we see a big focus from customers in on things like EV charging. And I think we're seeing that from the communities that we're in as well. So definitely a focus there. When our customers, there are three trends that I'd say we're seeing in ESG. First, let me just start by saying all of our major customers have very aggressive goals when it comes to ESG. But within those trends, there's a very heavy focus on renewables and transportation. You know, the cost of the supply chain rent is only 4 or 5%. Transportation and labor are much bigger categories. The same is true when you look into ESG categories. Transportation has such a big impact on the planet. So we see a big focus on EV charging. We see a big focus on solar. The second thing I'd notice, we're seeing a lot of pressure downstream. And the smaller and mid-sized firms, Rob talked about visibility throughout the supply chain through blockchain. We're also seeing that in ESG ways. So companies want to know what their suppliers are doing to make their supply chain greener. The third thing is a focus on social. You know, it's harder and harder to get those projects entitled close in, very difficult with last mile. And last mile is key if you want to compete in today's e-com world, where consumer expectation is you're going to get it not in a few days, but you're going to get it that day and maybe in a few hours.
So if we just keep going with it, because I think ESG is, as you say, it's become thankfully so important to everyone. As you say, it's not just about what you do as a business, but it's what your suppliers are doing. And I guess that then relates to what you're telling your customers. So to touch on Rob's earlier point about buildings and industrial parks, and maybe start with you, Rob, are you seeing shifts in the way that developers are thinking about building design? And what is it that they need to take into consideration now that perhaps a few years ago they weren't?
The answer is a really simple one to that, Michael. The answer is absolutely yes, categorically yes. It's hugely important to all our investor and developer clients in terms of the building suitability from both the environmental element and indeed the social element as well in terms of worker welfare. And we haven't really had the opportunity to explore that in real detail. But what is it about the building environment and its surroundings that makes it an attractive place to work for the labor within the warehouse? So the answer to that is it's an absolute yes. It's one of the top criteria for our occupier clients. And equally, it is one of the absolute top criteria for our developer investor clients.
Rob, in a sense, I think a lot of the trends we've talked about overlap. You know, the challenges with labor tie very closely into what you've just described, and attracting and retaining talent has become so difficult. It's probably a shift in focus within ESG toward health and well-being. We see it in things like well buildings, the well-certified buildings that look at the environment within the building, in and around the building, the air quality, keeping people healthy, We see it in things like our Parklife program, which we launched in the UK. So not just a logistics park, but an actual park, a feeling of place where you might have trails or places to be. And we're starting to look at it through amenities. I mean, traditionally, logistics real estate, when you had a few people moving around a few pallets, amenities didn't matter as much. But now that it's a big workplace with a lot of labor, you need to make sure the amenities match that.
And Michael, if I could just jump in there as well, just to add on, it's not just about the built environment. And I can't speak for North America, but in Europe, the EU is putting huge amounts of money in terms of the green agenda, in terms of infrastructure. So the 10T policy has been going for many decades now, but we're seeing a huge investment in inland waterways, rail, and indeed road in parts as well, to try and alleviate a congestion. I mean, a staggering statistic is that road congestion in Europe for the next 6-7 years could cost in the order of 200 billion euros. To give you a sense of scale of that, that's the size of the Czech Republic GDP. So anything that can avoid congestion and the environmental impact that causes, and also by definition, diverts and supports the movement of goods onto other and alternative infrastructure other than road, is very much part of EU policy.
And what would that be? Because I've seen videos of electric cars, but also electric lorries. And I've certainly seen those, I think, beginning to be operational in the US. That doesn't deal with congestion, but it deals with the pollution part. But what is the alternative that could be considered?
Well, inland waterways in continental Europe and not so much in the UK, but in continental Europe still remain a major artery. If you look at the amount of goods moved by them, it's still relatively low. But I'll give you one example. The Danube has 57 inland ports on it, which is an extraordinary statistic. And you can navigate from the Black Sea and Constanza all the way up to ultimately Rotterdam via the Danube and then some other tributaries. So inland waterways, electric barges, but also actually road infrastructure, which can actually shorten distances. And there's a good example between Germany heading into Scandinavia. So, you know, it's a combination of things. It's not a single fix, but it is very much a commitment by the European government. And interestingly as well, I was reading the other day that a number of the parcel operators have joined together collaboratively with their own green agenda targets to reduce their own greenhouse gas emissions, which are more aggressive than those imposed by the or sanctioned by the Paris Accord.
Interesting. And maybe just to wrap up one last thing, and you sort of touched on this, but we haven't really gone into any detail. So kind of widening the conversation out, you know, a future trend, is nearshoring, onshoring something that you think is going to happen more because of geopolitics and because of automation and AI? Or is that kind of wishful thinking? Let me throw that back to you, Jeremy, maybe for the last kind of words on something that we've read a little bit about. I know that Boeing have brought some manufacturing back to the US, whether that's because of the incumbent in the White House, or whether it's something more than that. Kind of interested in your views generally.
Michael, I think it's a variety of things. I think politics and national security will lead to some reshoring on certain items. Certainly, I think there's a lot of momentum behind pharmaceutical and maybe PP&E. Now, those aren't huge space-intensive items typically, so I don't know that they have a huge impact on the logistics market. I think what's more pronounced is risk in the supply chain. So what we see from customers is not necessarily moving out of China. The infrastructure, the talent in place in China is enormous. But we see a diversification of their supply chain, which that's where we've seen a lot of reshoring and nearshoring. Maybe they're manufacturing part of their product in China and part of it in Mexico in a nearshoring effort. So we see those type of things that are a function of de-risking the supply chain, which again has been focused on efficiency for all these years. And now I think something like COVID and the trade tensions prior have shown the cracks and the risks that existed all along. And that's where we've led to a higher resiliency.
And that's back to your comment earlier on when you were talking about a shift from just in time to just in case. That's the just in case being what happens if something goes wrong. And of course, I guess pre-pandemic, we had tsunamis disrupting supply chains. We had political arguments disrupting them. And so it's those sort of almost unforeseen, we never know exactly when they're going to happen, but unforeseen events that have made companies realize they can't be so lean that they get an interruption.
Well put.
Good. Well, I think on that note, you know, fascinating conversation, lots to talk about. Clearly, there's a lot that's going to change over the next few years. It's been great talking to you both. So Jeremy and Rob, thank you both very much indeed for your time and your input.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.